Okay,
we'll see what's firmly in going, okay?
There's two of them, and they stayed in the exact same spot the whole time. They're not sorry, like I say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
All right, Lisa,
are you ready for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that these days like these.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello and welcome to program 450 in the current series of Strange Days Indeed. Can't believe it, 450 programs over the last 9 years. On the program this time, Dave Verlott with his take on it. An update on last year's Chicago O'Hare International UFO by Don Ledger. NARCAP published a report on that incident, and we'll discuss that with Don. And a moment I never thought I would hear, actually several moments, Paul Kimball, documentary maker, and Alfred Lemberg discuss various things about ufology, including Paul's appearance with his documentary at the recent X conference in a suburb of Washington, D.C. All of those people coming up on this edition, 450 of Strange Days Indeed.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Verlott.
Is ufology anti-science? That's the post that has been going on for some time now on the UFO updates list, and many people have weighed in on the discussion, including some real scientists in the ufological community like Stanton Friedman. Now, the post attacks the very heart of ufology and ufologists by posing the first question as to whether ufology, the study of UFOs, is a science or a pseudoscience. Now, to be fair in this situation, pseudoscience is any body of knowledge, methodology, belief, or practice that claims to be scientific or is made to appear scientific but does not adhere to the basic requirements of the scientific method. And the scientific method is a body of techniques for investigating phenomena, acquiring new knowledge, or correcting and integrating previous knowledge based on gathering observable, empirical, and measurable evidence subject to specific principles of reasoning. The scientific method consists of the collection of data through observation and experimentation and the formulation and testing of hypotheses. Now, those definitions are from the online encyclopedia known as Wikipedia. And when you finally uncross your eyes and brain from deciphering them, it all boils right back down to whether ufology is a pseudoscience. Many claim that it is, simply based on the absence of obtaining something that is measurable or capable of us doing some experimentation. It's real simple. We don't have a ship, a pilot from a ship, an ashtray from some downed UFO, or even a hunk of heat shield, or even some space dust they picked up along the way to play with. Or do we? Several countries have been accused of collecting and gathering up a crashed UFO and squirreling it away from prying eyes, particularly the prying eyes of ufologists. So in black and white, no measurable evidence means there's no scientific method, which means it's a pseudo science. And if it's a pseudoscience, it must be, by all definition, an anti-science. Right? Wrong. For decades now, every ufologist I know of has been begging to have ufology investigated by scientists. And some brave scientists have come forward and done everything they can to gather, prepare, and present evidence that proves UFOs exist. They are real, and our planet is being visited on a pretty regular basis. The sad thing is that some of those scientists have suffered as a result of their hard work, suddenly losing their grants for scientific study, or their jobs at facilities of higher learning, or simply being ostracized by the scientific community for their efforts. All of that means that anyone who thinks about investigating UFOs has to think twice, and they have to weigh the consequences of their actions against the consequence of inaction. To me, it boils down to a measure of bravery. And what that bravery means is that every scientist that ventures forth to investigate ufology needs to be welcomed. They need to be welcomed with open arms by all of us that have an interest in the field. And don't get me wrong, I'm not talking about scientists that have their mind made up already in either direction. The scientists that begin examining what they have with the mindset that UFOs are real and they're going to prove it are just as dangerous as the ones that think it is all hogwash and they are going to prove their belief. Yes, that's right. I said belief. To my way of thinking, a true scientist is going to set out to simply prove or disprove a hypothesis, and they are completely open-minded to getting a negative result. No, ufology is not anti-science. If anything, the hard work done and being done by hundreds and sometimes thousands of people over the decades proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that ufology truly is a science that is working hard to gain acceptance by the scientific community at large. Groundwork has been laid and slowly is being built upon that proves that UFOs do exist. The only question that needs to be proven at this time is, what are UFOs? But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
And I can hear the many hands clapping. Nicely put, Dave.
Thank you.
I think there are far too many scientists, and we've discussed this many times on this program before, there are far too many scientists who are happy just to ignore what it is that's going on around them and focus on maintaining their funding and maintaining their tenure.
Exactly. Position, tenure, funding.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of they're looking at the consequences. If they come forward and try and investigate, they're putting their neck on the line. If they do nothing, then there's no consequence. So it's easy for them to sit back and say, yeah, let somebody else do it.
Yeah.
What we have to do as a community is every one of them that does take that step forward, we have to welcome them. Even if we disagree with something that they say or something that they're thinking, we still have to welcome them because it gets us a step further.
Does that include people like Michael Sala?
Oh, wow.
Exopolitics?
Oh, no. We have to be wary of the scientists that already have their mindset made up in one particular area.
Well, yes.
And aren't willing to listen to reason.
Mm-hmm. And that boils back to Stanton T. Friedman's investigation by proclamation.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't know what you're talking about, shut up, Stan says.
He's right on. And he's one of the scientists within the ufological community that's just done amazing work.
I can think of almost a dozen scientists
mm-hmm.
who've done amazing work around the field.
Ted Phillips. Trace evidence that they go out and gathering. People investigating crop circles. at the scientific level, right down to the gene structure of the bloody plants.
Nancy Talbot and Levengood.
Yes, Levengood and Talbot basically get right down and dirty in the scientific evidence of what happens in crop circles, determining whether or not they can be done here on this planet with stuff that we have.
Mm-hmm. And apparently the changes in the plants, we can't do that because it requires temperatures of 800 degrees for us to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that we subject to 800 degrees Fahrenheit is not going to leave much of the plant.
That's right.
If anything at all, other than a little pile of gray ash.
And that's part and parcel of it. We have these scientists that are doing that work. That is the groundwork. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which proves beyond a shadow of a doubt, in my mind, UFOs exist. End of statement on that one. What they are, however, is what's up for question. Because we're not sure. They could be coming from another planet. They could be coming from another dimension. They could be anything. Another time, even.
Yeah.
We just simply don't know what they are. They exist. There's no question. UFOs exist. Anybody with a functioning brain that looks even just at a little of the evidence has to believe that.
Well, has to know that.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference between belief and knowing.
Yes, that's true.
There are a lot of us who've had very strange experiences.
Mm-hmm.
We are not believers, we are knowers.
Yeah, we've seen it firsthand, like my experience last summer. I know what I saw was a UFO.
Did we talk about that on this program?
We've touched briefly on it, I think.
Well, so tell us what you saw, Dave.
Basically, it was a situation where I came home, and what I saw was a light that varied in intensity. This was broad daylight. And it moved very slowly, and basically it winked out. It vanished. I've seen aircraft lights. I've seen aircraft coming into Pearson, and seen aircraft coming into Buttonville with their landing lights on. This was not an aircraft with a landing light on.
Wasn't reflection off an aircraft, and when it turned, the reflection disappeared.
No. This was definitely something that was not an aircraft, not a helicopter, it wasn't a plane, and it was also moving in a different direction than it would be if it was coming in on a landing or a takeoff from either Pearson or Buttonville. I immediately ruled those out one by one as I was watching this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a situation where it literally disappeared. And we're talking broad daylight.
Yeah.
And we're talking a cloudless sky.
Tom Theophanis had a sighting himself last summer, too.
Mm-hmm.
On his way to pick up Lise, his wife, going north on the 400, almost at Canada's Wonderland, for people who don't know. It's your basic theme park. He had a sighting of a very strange object. He kept it inside as he went north of the theme park, pulled into where his wife works and wanted her to come out and take a look. And by the time he got her outside, it was gone. Tom is a very smart investigator. He was head of investigation for MUFON Ontario. So he did ask himself all the right questions as he was seeing it.
That's the part and parcel of it all. And it's interesting the effect that it has on us. Because as I was watching this thing, I was basically saying, okay, I know it's not that. I know it's not that. I know it's not that. As you get further and further down the list, and it'll start eliminating stuff, you're going, oh, boy.
My first sighting.
Yeah, sort of type thing.
And a daylight sighting.
Yeah, and a daylight sighting at that.
For both of you.
So it's sort of like, whoa, okay.
Oh, just another mystery.
Oh, yeah.
We're getting used to those, though, aren't we? Maybe a little too used to them.
We have so many mysteries within this field. It just boggles the mind to think of all of them. They just keep being added to. We can't get the answers, unfortunately, on probably, 90% of the bona fides? There's still all kinds of theories being tossed out there, but we really can't say for sure.
Not being able to say for sure is, I think, where we'll leave it this time, Dave Verlot.
We have to.
Yeah. Yes, we do. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Talk to you next time.
For sure.
Dave Verlot. DaveForLot.com. Ooh.
That gives me impetus. As soon as I get my new system up and running, that's going to be my first project.
So DaveFurlot.com is the place to go, and talk to you next time.
For sure.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Don Ledger is a fairly frequent contributor to this program on matters aviational. He's the Canadian representative up here in Canada for the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. And a few weeks ago, NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, published its findings on the Chicago O'Hare International Airport UFO back in November of 2006. A long document, eh, Don Ledger?
Approximately 152 pages, Errol, of information regarding that particular incident under the auspices of the chief scientist there, Dr. Richard Haynes, formerly of NASA Ames at Moffett Field in Washington State. He spent probably about 6 months on this, along with some other people, and brought together all of the information that each person was working on into the report. It's fairly comprehensive. It probably answers some questions and asks some questions as well.
A lot of technical reports in there, and I must point out that you spent a lot of time putting it together in its present state as a PDF file, as well as contributing to the report, I believe, on the radar facilities at O'Hare.
I had very little to do with the radar. That was Martin Schuff from Great Britain. I did do the PDF. My contribution was towards the end, explaining what, if pilots were coming in or leaving from O'Hare, or any airport for that matter, the workload that would be present at the time, stressing that there being such a workload that to acquiesce to some anomalous phenomena going on at the airport would be a big deal, you know, to drag them away from their workload, particularly on landing. That's when the pilot is the busiest. It would be quite a big deal for them to take the time to make note of it and report it, if indeed it was reported. We don't know for sure that that actually happened. Maybe we should give everybody a bit of a brief thumbnail update of what actually happened there. According to the NARCAP report, it was first noted by an air traffic controller, not necessarily seen from tower, but there was conversation about it over a half an hour before the actual incident, which is quite odd. This wasn't known when the report was first begun. At about 2 minutes to four. Now, the main activity seems to have taken place, a little bit of a flurry that went on, at about 4:30 in the afternoon. This is 32 minutes after an air traffic controller was speaking about it. So somebody noticed it before then. You know, one thing that's important about this particular report that sort of gets sloughed over, nobody pays much attention to it, the cloud base. The cloud base was an absolute 1,900 feet. All right, and that was measured by what's called a celiometer. They don't use weather balloons around these airports anymore, not at the big ones. Student Andrews, they have these things floating around in the same airspace with 100 airplanes buzzing around. So they use laser celiometers, and not only will it measure the first cloud base, but it'll measure the second one and the third one above that, too. And this one was measured as absolute at 1,900 feet. So you've got an absolute bottom to this thing. This was solid all over the airport. So now the object was suspected to being at between maybe 1,500 to 1,800 feet in the air. I always place great importance on that cloud base because now we know the altitude, which is not very high. With people that are used to looking at airplanes and so on, that's nothing. Over any busy airfield, you know, 1,800 feet is quite low.
So there you have this disc hanging out of the United Airlines terminal building at the second busiest airport in North America, if not the world.
In the world.
Concourse C of United Airlines Terminal. It's hanging in the sky up there. Air traffic control has seen it. There's been discussion about it. for at least a half an hour before it was finally spotted, which is bizarre to me, by a mass of witnesses.
This information, of course, didn't come out until later on, but a maintenance man with United Airlines who was taxiing a 747. Now, this guy had been working there for 30 years. He was a highly qualified individual. He was one of the first to notice it while he was taxiing the airplane by looking up through the window. So he must have got on ground control frequency and told somebody, because the word got around. Another handler who had his headset plugged into the nose of another aircraft he was working at one of the other gates looked up and he saw it. And nearly a dozen people on the ground saw it. A supervisor came out after he was made aware of it. Somebody called on the company radio, which is not a public frequency, and he went outside and he saw it. He talked to the tower about it, who could not see it. This is sort of important. The fact that they couldn't see it. The FAA were aware of it. This was ongoing at the time. And then when it was first brought up, they denied anything had happened. And then when they were confronted with the evidence of their own reports and so on, well, it was weather phenomenon, which everybody, frankly, says is silly. And numbers didn't. But the other thing is, who in the FAA has the qualifications to say that it's weather phenomenon? They're not the U.S. Weather Office. And they can't make a claim like that, just right off the cuff. It was just a spokesman for the FAA came out with this nonsensical explanation, which just didn't hold water at all. A considerable amount of investigation went on to see if it could have been seen by radar, which apparently it could not be seen by radar where it was. And this is very curious. It managed to pick the one spot on the airport that was blind to radar and the tower.
Isn't that peculiar?
Yeah, isn't it?
It puzzles me that there would be any blind spots in the air at 1,800 feet around Chicago O'Hare.
There is. They are air traffic controllers, but they're tower controlled, principally concerned with aircraft in their area that's coming in, and nobody's going to be coming in at 1,800 feet over the airfield unless they're vectored through there, and it's not likely going to be the case unless it was a helicopter being vectored through or something like that, and it would be vectored through, not hovering. Not only is that a good spot to hover, because of the way the cab is built on the tower, it sticks up there about 200 feet. It's very high. But because of the way that the cabs are made in these towers to prevent glare and so on, that altitude, around 1,800 feet, in that particular area, keeps it away from any runways and also keeps it out of sight of the tower personnel, Chicago O'Hare Tower. I found that highly unusual, too. These things knew just where to park and stay out of harm's way and at the same time stay out of the tower's line of sight. And the only people that were going to see it were people directly below it on the ground. Or anybody else around the airport that was in, you know, a half mile would probably see the thing up there in the sky if they were looking. It was described as being lead and gray in color. Well, so what's a thick cloud base, you know, at 4:30 in the afternoon in November going to look like? It's almost dark by then, right? It was almost like camouflaging itself, except it didn't do a very good job because everybody could see it plainly from the ground, I guess. Years ago, I would have thought to myself, well, you know, that's just a little too much of a stretch. But if you keep seeing it over and over and over again, I don't mean particularly at an airport, it's these coincidences that happen, like these things just seem to be in the right place for certain people to see them and other people not to see them. You know yourself, Harold, that this pops up over and over and over again.
Indeed, and continues to puzzle. You said it was solid cloud at 1,900 feet.
Measured.
Absolute 1,900 feet. The object eventually punched a hole through that cloud, which hung around for about 20 minutes and through which you could see blue sky.
Yeah.
Has NARCAP covered that off in their report?
Yeah, there's a fairly extensive discussion on that in the paper to do with what might have been some kind of microwave energy, which I tend to agree with, coming off of this thing, possibly something to do with what motivates it, or something to do with how it maneuvers through the air without restriction. I tend to think that maybe the latter is the case. For about 13 to 14 minutes, the hole that it created when it went through was still discernible in the cloud. Now, I know that the cloud was fairly stable up there, but normally it doesn't take that long for it to close up. But maybe that was just the case. It's the thought that this thing burned its way through the cloud as it went through, like, and somehow whatever energy was coming off of that managed to dissipate the moisture in the cloud layers that were above. I believe there was three, possibly four, And that's quite a few cloud layers to go through before you're going to see blue sky. And but people could see blue sky through it. That's quite enormous.
Yeah, it's not something that we can create with any technology that we have.
No, well, if you fly a jet up through that, for instance, first thing's going to happen is you might see a little hole for a second, but the vortices coming off the jet, off the wings, the blast itself from the jet, is just going to create a swirling effect behind it, and it'll just all close up right after it. This energy that these things seem to be able to generate, not only do I find that unusual because of the hole that it created and how it created it, possibly as described in the paper as being some kind of very high rate of microwave energy, but when you realize that radar and transponders and so on all key on microwave energy, in other words, it's a transmission rate, very high frequencies, and that there are quite a few anomalies surrounding transponder code, spurious ones that are being seen to be squawked when there's no airplanes around and just staying in one particular place, or what's called TCAS alerts, which is traffic collision avoidance systems that the airliners have on board to separate one another, and they key off of transponders. I know this is getting a little bit technical now, but this is how the system works, and that's all microwaves, and quite often TCAS alerts happen with what's called the resolution advisory. That's the TCAS tells you to climb left or right or push the nose down or whatever to get away from whatever the threat is. And yet there's nothing there. Air traffic control sees nothing. Nothing is showing up. And yet these TCAS continue to go off for no good reason. So I think they might be keying on some sweep of energy that might be coming off of one of these things if they're close enough. And that's what's setting them off. But I can't prove that, but there's a lot of them out there. I see them at least two or three times a week.
Now, of course, radar works on microwave, too.
As well, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a known quantity. But where's the unknown quantity come from when there's nothing to set them off? Radar is not going to set them off because they're not set to be keyed on by radar to set them off. It's too difficult to get in on here without diagrams and pictures, you know, and explanations and so on.
You and I have in the past on this program talked about the false IDs showing up. Each aircraft has its own ID, which shows up on air traffic radar as a distinct code, as a distinct number. And you and I have talked about the incident that happened at Mirabel Airport north of Montreal here in Canada, where one of these IDs hung out over the button on the runway, as pilots call it, at the point where they aim to put their wheels down on the runway.
Exactly, yeah.
And this thing hung out for over an hour. There were no reports about it. And you followed up on the story.
Yeah. Quickly on transponder so people understand it. Not all airplanes, but most of them nowadays do have a transponder in them. And there's different degrees of sophistication on transponders, which I don't want to get into right now, but let's call the mode A and mode C. And there's mode M transponders. It's a little box in your airplane that you can dial codes into. Between 1,000 and 7777. Private aircraft or an airliner taking off will set their code at around 1,200. That's the normal set. And then if you're asked to do so by air traffic control, you set it to something else, and you can press a button, and the bloom that will show up in the radar will indicate exactly where you were. Now, how this thing works is it's a little microwave transmitter on its own, but it's also a receiver. So whenever radar sweep comes around and hits the thing, it automatically receives that and then pulses out a little piece of energy that's slightly stronger than the pulse it received. And then that's perceived by either tower or air traffic control on their radar screens. And they see you there. If you're talking to them or if they're able to get a hold of you, they might ask you to set another code so they'll know for sure it's you. Say 2420 or something like that. So you dial up 2420 and then you press the ident button. And that'll really make a bloom show up in their radar screen with that code showing. So they know exactly who you are.
Right.
All right. So now, in this particular night, this was only a few months ago at Mirabel. The two runways at Mirabel are east-west and then slightly north-south, but they're separated by about 3,000 feet and joined by taxiways. They're sort of like two wings. At the very center, in the very center of the airport, they were getting a transponder code, 1003. Varying between 0 feet and 500 feet above the threshold of the east-west runway or the section at the center of the airport. It was at night, around 9:30 in the evening. The transponder code continued to key off, go on and off, for an hour and 16 minutes. And there was nothing there to explain it. There was no aircraft in the air, no helicopters hanging there, obviously. If they're going to be hanging there, they know about it. They have to have permission to be there. So that wasn't the case. Now, it was not only being picked up by Mirabel, but it was being picked up at Dorval, which is about 17 miles away from Mirabel. So they were receiving the same transponder code. Nobody could determine that there was any aircraft there, so where was this thing coming from? They couldn't see it.
Mm.
I assume they probably sent even maybe a vehicle out on the end of the runway to have a look. But when I contacted the shift manager at Montreal Center to ask about this, they were aware of it, was in the logs, but they had no resolution for it. They didn't know what happened there. And this is very curious. Where did this come from? Just right out of nowhere. You were getting a transponder code. It's like an invisible airplane hovering over the field, squawking a code to let them know they were there, but nobody could see it. Very anomalous, you know?
And nobody followed up on it.
This is what we hear all the time, that nobody seems to be interested in it, but were they? I was unable to determine whether NORAD was notified, and quite often they'll do that, right? Then NORAD would take over from there, but if they do anything about it, I don't know. Once you get into that's the government system, that's Canada, U.S., North American, Great Air Defense Command. I think they're basically really bored with UFO reports from us anyway, because they know what it's all about. We don't need the report. We know, you know.
Yeah, or they don't know what it's all about, and there's no point in trying to investigate because.
They know it's there. They're well aware of the phenomenon. They can't resolve it themselves, so they've either given up on it or they've gone deeper with it. And it could go either way, you know. Who knows?
Let's go back to Chicago O'Hare, November 2006, and the recent report and a substantial report that was issued by NARCAP. Did they come up with any new witnesses in the course of their looking into it?
Yeah. If you go through the report, you'll see there are other witnesses in there. Unfortunately, most of them are protected. They don't want their names mentioned. There were people on the ground that weren't right in the center of the airport around Concord C that were either coming into the parking lots or outside the area, in other words, that reported an object. Not always right at the time either, sometimes sooner, but right up until the time. But everybody agrees that there was this object. There were pilots that saw this too, okay, on the ground. What I found curious was that apparently nobody was talking on ground control. And let me just explain that. When you're at an airport and you're a pilot and you're taxiing around, before you go out on the runway, you're under the control of ground control, which is still air traffic control. Sometimes these guys are working in the tower, sometimes they're working ground control. So you've got tower and ground control. But at a big airport like Chicago O'Hare, you not only have ground control, but you have ground control approach, which is the airplanes that are coming in, have landed, are coming off the runway. Once they come off the runway, they're out of tower control's area, and they switch over to ground control approach. And then if you're getting ready to leave, you're under ground control departure until you taxi past the whole line onto the runway. Once you go past the whole line onto the runway, you go to tower control. Plus, they also have a new taxiing and runway control system that's a radar that keys on something like 3 times a second, so they can actually see the traffic on the runways that's moving around. It's a look-down system that works right off the tower or the tower, and it wasn't looking up in the direction of whatever object was up there. It was well below that. It managed to pick itself, again, a good little spot. All of this activity that had to be going on, somebody must have mentioned it on ground control, but when the Freedom of Information came back, there was no indication that anybody was talking on ground control about it. But it was noted at the tower, they were discussing it, that other people on the ground were discussing it. They weren't discussing it among themselves as having seen it. So they apparently did not see this thing themselves at the tower.
You had mentioned earlier on a mechanic.
He probably broke the story. He went to Peter Davenport at the UFO Reporting Center in the U.S., again at Washington State. He reported it to him, and Peter sat on it for a couple of weeks. He gave it to NARCAP so they could get a head start on it. But then Peter wanted to see if he could get some more information about this, and he went to John Hilkovich at the Chicago Tribune.
What about the guy in the report, the maintenance guy who was on a headset that was plugged into the nose of one of the aircraft there?
Maybe they were operating on company frequency at this point. A ground handler will have his headset plugged right into the nose of the aircraft so he can talk directly to the pilot through an intercom system. He became aware of this object as well and mentioned it to the pilot. At that point, I think that's when the pilots of the aircraft became aware of this. Maybe that's how the word got around at the time. It doesn't appear to have gotten around on ground control. And I'm sure other pilots as well that saw it. It's very hard to get pilots to talk about this sort of thing, even if they do see it.
So what conclusions has NARCAP come to about this case? And anything that would help perhaps clear up the mystery or contribute to the knowledge base that we already have?
Certainly more witnesses to the event. Some of them on the ground, some of them who were civilians outside. Usual, Carol, there is no conclusion. I don't know how there can be a conclusion to this phenomenon. NARCAP believes something happened there, that this was a real event, and that the FAA has to start to look at this more carefully as a hazard to flights happening over the second busiest airport in the world. It has to have some repercussions. Somebody has to pay attention and say, well, God, we can't have this going on. I mean, whether they like it or not,
There's
not much they can do about it, but...
No.
Why isn't there a big deal made about this? Was a big deal made about it, of course.
Well, they don't want to scare people, and they don't want to admit that there's something going on that they, A, can't control, and, B, know absolutely nothing about.
No, true. United Airlines forbidding their people to talk about it, which is, frankly, illegal. They can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
The pressure on pilots would be considerable not to say anything about it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we run into this all the time. I run into it all the time.
So we continue on with the mystery, Don Ledger, and no resolution as far as NARCAP is concerned.
No. The mystery continues until the next mystery comes along.
That report is available at the NARCAP website, which is narcap.org, and there's a link there right on the front page.
The report number 10.
Report number 10.
Case number 18.
And so the mystery continues. Don Ledger, thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on, Harold. It's always a pleasure to be on here.
And if there happen to be any Canadian pilots listening to this program, Don Ledger would love to hear from you. You can link to him via the program listing at virtuallystrange.net. His image is there. There's a link. It'll take you to a short biography of Don's and an email link, too. And, of course, you can go to donledger.com. I guess we can announce that now, eh?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. Author of the Shag Harbor incident, Don Ledger is our East Coast correspondent. Thank you, Don.
Thank you very much, Earl.
Ago, there was the X conference that happened down there outside Washington, D.C. Stephen G. Bassett staged the third X conference, and Paul Kimball, famed Canadian UFO documentary maker, attended. Alfred Lindbergh was interested in talking to Paul about that conference, as was I. So, meetings of minds here on Strange Days Indeed. This time, we head down to Enterprise, Alabama, and out to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where Alfred Lindbergh and Paul Kimball reside, and they join us. Good day, gentlemen.
Hello, Errol. Hello, Alfred.
Hi there.
Hello, it's the opening to a Peter Gabriel song. Hi there.
The voice of the radio pro. Paul Kimball, a long trip for you this past trip down to the States, which I guess started at the X conference.
Yeah, I was gone for, three and a half weeks, I guess. I actually wound up, almost four, I wound up staying 4 or 5 days longer in Los Angeles because I had... The official reason, according to me, as far as my brother's concerned, who cooks the books at the company, is I had business to do, which is partly true. And the unofficial reason is I had business and I just wanted to stay in L.A. longer because it was nice and warm. It's not so warm here, so.
The conference was actually what, in Bethesda?
Gaithersburg.
How long did you spend down there?
Flew in on Thursday the 13th and we flew out Monday morning. Relatively early, so I guess I was the one person on the conference bill or whatever that didn't do the press conference. There were a couple of others that didn't want to, but they'd already committed to it, so they went ahead and did it, and the night before over drinks were commiserating as to how they could get out of town early, too. But Yeah, no, it was fun. I joke, mostly.
You were making it sound like there's a real divestiture and a division of camps down there.
Oh, no, there was. There's no question that the first thing, because I remember listening to you guys before I went, saying Dave Filott as well, wondering, oh, what's he doing going down there? And furthermore, what's he going to think? Stranger in a strange land kind of thing. And, you know, I come away with two things. The same thing I came away the last time I went to the Laughlin Conference out in Nevada in 2006. They're all good people. Whatever criticisms I would have of exopolitics are not personal. Having said that, I have, if I bother to pay any attention anymore at all, a number of criticisms about exopolitics, all of which were just reconfirmed at the conference. But there were guys, too, like Bruce McAbee. It was nice to see Bruce again. Nick Pope, Richard Dolan, who I have many disagreements with, but certainly respect his talent and his initiative and what he's done. And he's a good guy. There's no question about that. So good guys can disagree with each other pleasantly, especially when liquor's involved. And who else? Rob Simone was there. So there were people there that I have respect for. And then there were other people there and who I agree with, at least in some cases. And then there were other people there that, you know, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, are just out to lunch. But they're very nice people.
Would you care to name names of the out to lunchies?
Sure. Everybody I didn't just name. That's not quite true. Alfred Weber, Michael Sala, Paula Harris. It should be no secret that those are the head exopolitics types. And
they're real fringers as far as the UFO field is concerned.
That's the thing, too, I've learned. Ufology probably paid them far too much attention, and I did, too, a year or two or three ago. I remember discussions on your list and people writing in blogs and all sorts of other stuff. And the truth is, I think the 200 adherents to exopolitics were at the conference, and I don't think they were all adherents. In fact, I know they weren't. I was sitting next to some people who their eyes would roll. Outside the conference, I don't think anybody really pays them any attention at all. So, whereas you have guys like Stan Friedman or Kevin Randall or Jerry Clark through their books or Nick Redfern that the general public pays at least some attention to some of the time, I think people were a little too worried about exopolitics and the effect it would have. And the truth is, most people don't pay UFOs attention at all, and when they do, they're not going to exopolitics. They're going usually to guys like Stan Friedman or whomever. So the exopolitics stuff to me is goofy and wacky and kind of fun, and that's about it.
I was detecting a lot more warmth from you while you were writing from there and subsequently than I'm getting from you here on the radio.
Well, I don't mean to sound cold and chilly. It's just that it's cold and chilly here in Canada. Everybody's entitled to their opinion, and they have their opinion, and they're good people. I talked to all of them, I think, with one or two exceptions. Everybody was extremely charming and friendly. And I sort of tried to fit it into the way that I would look at religion. Not that I'm religious, but, or politics or whatever. You can look at religion and say, well, look, there's the Pope and the Dalai Lama and sort of serious religious leaders. And then you shouldn't confuse that with, I don't know, Benny Hinn or whatever, some of the guys who are out there. And let me tell you, I was sitting with a couple of guys in the audience, and as soon as Stephen Greer walked on the stage, Benny Hinn was the consensus. And Greer is the exception to the rule of everything I just said about...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. Well, look, Greer is the exception to the rule of everything I just said about all the other guys who are nice people and don't seem to be in it to drum up some evangelical fervor and money or whatever it is they're doing. Greer showed up, didn't see him for the entire conference, did his dog and pony show, which really did seem like a Benny Hinn old-time religion kind of thing, and then left. He wasn't even there for the final panel. And so I would say to Bassett, you want to bring the exopolitics guys in, great, whatever, you know, fine. But if you're going to bring people into a conference, the one thing you should, having organized a conference myself, the one thing you should make sure of is that these guys or girls commit to being there from day one and pretty much as they can until the end of the time. And the only reason, I joke, but the only reason I wasn't there for the final press conference is the only flight I could get that fit our budget leaving Washington for L.A. on Monday morning was during the press conference. Otherwise, we would have had to blow out at about 9 o'clock in the evening. So I would have been there to support my friend Nick Pope if I could have been, but I couldn't. But Greer came, saw, conquered, left, sold a few books, bought the T-shirt, and that was it.
With regard to Greer, what do you attribute the strange mix of legitimacy and buffoonery that he's got going?
I would attribute the legitimacy to those good people like Bob Salas, who signed on way back when they didn't know what they were signing on for. and I would attribute the buffoonery to Dr. Greer. So it's very simple. He's responsible for all the crazy goofiness, and the good people that he had, and some of the disclosure witnesses were good people like Bob Salas, others were not. Those people have been undermined by their association with Dr. Greer over the years. I know, I've talked to some of them. Most of the ones I've talked to that I consider good witnesses regret ever having been involved. They might not say that publicly on the record. They've said it privately. And I wouldn't be surprised now, after his appearance at the X conferences, if a few of them didn't say it publicly. There's no question that they're good people, and I think Dick Hall and others have made this point for many years now, that the entire disclosure thing has tainted these good witnesses by linking them in the public mind, or allowing people to link them in the public mind, with crazy Dr. Greer and the bad witnesses. And there were bad witnesses, isn't even the right word, you know, frauds, hucksters, liars, whatever you want to call them, that he also...
Hey, do you think that could be as a result of some kind of design to do that?
There are people within the UFO community, I know, who think that Greer is a disinformation agent. Serious people, too, like people that I have a great deal of respect for, have posited that idea to me as well, and I don't buy it. I mean, I've interviewed Dr. Greer, I've met him, I've seen him now in action a couple of times, and if it is just all an act, at least the kind of act that you don't see on a regular basis in televangelists or whatever, then he deserves an Oscar, and you should probably give him Gore's Peace Prize, too. I mean, he should get every award in the book.
Yeah, and really, you kind of have to judge a tree by its fruit, don't you?
Yeah, generally speaking. His fruit is pretty fruity. It's got nuts in it, too.
Well, downright toxic in some cases, and like you say, if he's part of some kind of disinformation effort, putting good and bad together and calling them the same the way he has, you know, what have we got?
Well, could he be disinformation? I suppose there's a small infinitesimal chance that there was a gig that Rick Doty wasn't required for, so they get somebody else. But I think people are too quick to cry disinformation when any of this stuff comes up. And I would just say, look, there are bad people in the world, there are nutty people in the world, there are dishonest people in the world, and any walk of life has them. And I've been picking on religion. They certainly have them, but they also have a lot of good people, too, whether you believe in religion or not. There are good priests, there are good ministers, there are good leaders in any religion. And I would say those are the people that get the public attention, or should. And my problem with the media is not that they ignore UFOs. My problem is one of the few things that when they do pay attention to, they focus on the nuts as opposed to focusing on all the good people.
And maybe that could be designed too.
Possibly. Although I know a fair bit about the media, and I don't think it is. I just think that they view it as an that's a very long, long conversation, most of which has to do with the Condon Report, and I could go back into history and why that's been like it has for 35 or 40 years, because it was not always thus. But at the end of the day, the truth is they tend to focus on sort of the wackier fringe elements of what many people think is a wacky fringe thing anyway, and that's a shame. And I kind of hope my film does its little bit to change that, and there are other people who have films that hopefully will change that. And not just films, but people who write books and stuff. I mean, there's information out there, and I find that when people see it, in my case see it, or in other people's cases read it, they sort of go, well, we don't know about the alien thing. We're not sure. Interesting. But this is interesting, Paul. Maybe we should look more into it. Why don't people fund this? And I go, well, you're a taxpayer. Why don't you ask your MP? Or in the U.S., your congressperson or whatever. So,
and that's why you were down there at the X conference this past September, because you were showing your, thus far, the magnum opus.
Yeah, well, magnum opus. I don't know about that. Yeah, no.
Don't demur, because the fact is, on this side of the aisle, that's exactly what you produced there, and it was a stellar effort, and I think we made that abundantly clear on the radio and in print.
Yeah, well, no, and while I was in Washington, it was nice. Chris and I went into the city for one day, and I walked into a Barnes & Noble or a Borders, whatever, one of the big bookstores, and I saw a UFO magazine. I was flipping through it. I said, oh, we don't really get this very often in Canada, so I'll buy a copy. And there was your review. It was the issue that had your review, so I bought all five copies. It's way cool. Nobody else in that section of Washington could read your review unless they had more on the back. So, yeah, thank you very much for your review, both on my behalf. And young Miss McBride also knew that I was coming on the show. And I said, oh, Alfred Lemerick's going to be on. She said, well, thank him very much for saying nice things about her and her work.
Well, you got to be nice for me to say nice things about you. I think you know that.
Well, no, I told her. I said, look, if there's one person on the planet who wouldn't do me any favors, it'd be Alfred Lemberg. So if he's writing nice things about you, then that means he sincerely, honestly believes them, as opposed to maybe my friend Joe, who's just saying them to make you feel good because he knows you're a friend of mine or something.
We have battled magnificently, haven't we?
Yeah, it was fun.
I'm looking forward to round two.
No more round two. It's a kinder, gentler Paul now. So even when I disagree with people, I just say, hey, look, let's get another Coors Light. You know, whatever it was Dolan and I were drinking at the bar.
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. I'm sure you're more stalwart than that.
Yeah.
Chris Lee McBride, the narrator of Paul Kimball's documentary for the uninitiated. Yeah.
And in a weird sort of ufological or whatever thing, her next project, which I'm talking to her about, we run it in late November, is a play called Doing Time, written by Mac Tonies, he of crypto-terrestrial post-human blues fame. I commissioned him to write a play based on one of his old sci-fi short stories, and the play has extraterrestrial life forms in it. So even in fiction, gentlemen, even in fiction, I'm trying to put forward the ufological agenda. So there you go.
Well, may it win a Tony.
A Mac Tony.
Yeah.
There you go.
Both McBride and Tonies are very, very singular individuals, it seems to me. There's something about either of them that is really, truly original and a wholly one of a kind, I think.
I couldn't agree more, and I probably shouldn't say anything else, especially with regard to Mac, because I think people are starting to wonder about the two of us. Now that he's shaved his hair, he looks like my friend Nick Redfern, and I've always had a bit of a crush on Nick, so...
You heard it here first, folks.
You do have editing software, right, Errol?
That's going in, dude.
that's going to live forever, Paul Kimball.
That's great. No, I was talking to him last night. I sort of say Nick Pope is the future of ufology, and that's not quite right. I think he's the guy now that could and should be the public face of ufology, and the more I got to know Nick when I was in Washington, the more I appreciate his common sense, sensible, skeptical, but open-minded look at all things to do with UFOs. And he certainly got a very high public profile courtesy of his years with the Ministry of Defense. So Hope, to me, for a whole host of reasons, should be the public face of the UFO thing. But Mac Tonies, Greg Bishop and I were talking about this when I was staying with him in L.A., and who would be the guy maybe after Pope? Because Mac's only 30 years old. So with a little more seasoning, he's already close. He's media savvy, he's well-spoken, articulate, intelligent, open-minded, but skeptical. To me, those are all the things that you should have. And so anything I can do to put Mac Tonies over, and in 5 or 10 years, hopefully he'll be a major presence. I mean, he's sometimes, and I mean this in the best possible way because I was a fan, and he certainly doesn't have the scientific credentials or any of that, but in many other respects, he's Sagan-esque. He almost sounds sometimes like Sagan just in the way he talks. He's very accessible in terms of how the public would view him. So, Max, listening to this, I don't mean to feed his already humongous, huge ego.
He has no ego like I know it's a joke, but the way you're describing, the guy has every reason to be snooty and standoffish and arrogant, but I don't get that from him at all.
Yeah,
in print or on the radio or anything.
It took years to get him on Strange Days Indeed. And it was, I think, thanks to you, Paul, because he was coming to do your conference a couple, 3 years ago.
That's right, yeah.
And up until then, he had absolutely refused to do any sort of interviews or radio or anything.
He doesn't think he's good.
And well, he is. He's wonderful.
Yeah, no, and he's coming to that realization, which is why his ego's growing. And I think having him in Best Evidence, it was great for the film, but it also helped him in the sense that I think once he saw it, he realized, yeah, you know what, I can actually even appear on television and be articulate and look good and all that sort of stuff.
I'm amazed. I had no idea he was that shy.
He is. And unlike me, he's the anti-me, because I'm not shy. But it's charming. I like it. And that's why I would say to people, if you think that the UFO world is Stephen Greer and Alfred Weber and that kind of stuff, if you do think that, well, no, it's really Nick Pope and Mac Tonies and Greg Bishop and Nick Redfern and the older guys like Jerry Clark and Dick Hall. You know, look, there's a long list of serious, sensible people here, and those are the ones you should be listening to. And the other stuff is, as Kevin Randall would say, just eyewash. You know, it's an amusing sideshow sometimes, but it's not the serious stuff.
And as you said, Nick Pope should be the new mouthpiece for ufology in the same way that Stanton T. Friedman has been for a very long time.
Yeah.
He's the inheritor of the cloak.
I obviously, on a couple of major things, have disagreements with Stan, but nothing but respect, and he's been, I think, on the whole, a good spokesperson, certainly for the extraterrestrial end of the UFO phenomenon. The primary disagreement I have with him is about that, extraterrestrial hypothesis versus extraterrestrial fact.
So, you know, still by your own admission, that's kind of the way you're leaning too.
Well, as I say, if somebody had to put a gun to my head and said, which of the paranormal explanations do you accept more than the others? I would say, well, sure, aliens. I'm not a crypto guy. I'm not a valet extra-dimensional guy because aliens make sense to me in the sense that it seems more plausible than the other ones. But I still sit on the fence and go, look, and this is what frustrates, I think, a lot of people sometimes. But at the end of the day, with proper investigation, blah, 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 all that stuff, it's possible that all of these cases may have prosaic explanations, or if not prosaic ones, at least ones that are rooted on this planet that maybe have nothing to do with other intelligences. I think that's possible. I'm smart enough to know that I don't know, so that's what I say. I say I don't know. I can't prove it. I couldn't go into a court of law and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's any of these things. So unless I can do that, and I buy the Sagan thing that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, I can't even muster proof. All I can do is muster proof that something there, and I made this point at the X conference, a lady, a very nice lady in the audience, went on about aliens after the screening, and she said, well, this proves aliens, right? And I went, no, to you it might, but I think you've already made up your mind. To me and some other people sitting out in the audience, very few, but there were a few, I think it proves there's something going on. What is that something? I don't know. But here, on Strange Days Indeed, I will say for the first time, as I get older and I look more and more into this, the one thing that I do sort of become more convinced about is that there is an intelligence behind it. I just don't know whose intelligence it is, so I can't ascribe a particular explanation to it. But those are the kind of guys I gravitate towards, Tonys, Redfern, Bishop, the guys who say, yeah, something's going on, we just don't quite know what it is. So it's probably no secret that the four of us and a few others have formed this cabal of evil that is wrecking havoc throughout the ranks of ufology or whatever.
So you do see yourself as kind of a united front, a cabal, if you will?
Yeah, well, you know, now that MJ-12 writes our paychecks, absolutely. Yeah, sure, look, part of it is we all get along. We're good friends. And I think it's just natural that you would gravitate towards hanging out with people you like. You know, we fall into the same age range between 30 and 45. So we have interests beyond ufology. Tim Banal is another one. Tim Banal is a good young guy, and we all have similar interests outside of just the UFO thing. But we all have a similar view, and I think more and more young people, honestly, having talked to them, the few that seem to care about UFOs, have the same view, which is, look, you've gone down the extraterrestrial thing for almost 60 years, certainly since Kehoe, really. It's time to take a step back and say, well, look, no, we can't prove it's aliens. Maybe it is, but we don't know. You've been saying you know for 40, 50 years, but you don't know. You know, you think you know, but you can't prove it. So what we like to do is, as you once said, Alfred, take a step back, and I really did only mean take one step back, and maybe start traveling to the left and right and look at a whole bunch of different possibilities and bring Valet and his conversation back into the fold and bring guys like Mac in, his cryptos. And whatever, and let's look at the entire range of things, because I think that's what the phenomenon demands.
What I would have accused you of once is by doing that, going crypto-terrestrial and trans-temporal, and was trying to make use of all of these different kind of things that UFOs could be. I would have accused you once of trying to dull the focus, you know, trying to take the sharpness off of the investigation. But I really don't think that you're doing that. I think you really genuinely are interested in all of these other things that UFOs could be. So I'm not going to campaign anymore about you trying to destroy some ufological focus by doing what you do.
Hurrah. No, thanks. The truth is, that's exactly what it always was, just a genuine curiosity and interest. And I think it's a good way to engage people or re-engage people. And that doesn't mean I buy any of those other hypotheses. Well, for instance, when a guy like Jerry Clark, who I respect, and I have most of his books, I think he is, despite my disagreements with him, the preeminent historian of the UFO phenomenon. Fine. But when Jerry Clark wanders on to UFO updates and basically says, and I paraphrase, but if you go back and read what he wrote, this is the gist of it. Mac Tonys is nuts. This theory is nuts. There's nothing to it. like, shut this guy up. And how would you react, Jerry, if somebody said that to you? Like, I don't know, the National Academy of Sciences or whomever. I know how you'd react. I've seen it over the years that I followed your writings. You don't react well. Nobody who's interested in the UFO phenomenon does. So you're, in essence, doing the exact same thing to a young guy coming up who's experimenting with some different ideas and trying to look at things in a different way. And you're telling him to shut up because he's crazy and his ideas have no merit. Well, boo on you is what I would say. And if that's what the extraterrestrial, and Jerry goes out of his way to say, I'm not an ETH guy. Well, yeah. You know, if you read what Jerry's written, it's pretty clear that that's the camp he generally falls in. But I would say if that's what the extraterrestrial fact people have led us down to, that you can't posit anything other than the extraterrestrial hypothesis as being possibly real, then UFOs not only are no longer anything even remotely resembling a serious scientific inquiry. I'm not sure it is, but if it ever was, it isn't anymore. And it's just not fun. And I'm sorry, folks, but if you want to get people interested in the UFO phenomenon, you have to kind of make it fun. And we were talking about this, Greg and I, when I was out in LA. At what point did UFOs stop being fun and exciting? And gee whiz, that kind of factor that maybe people in the 50s might have had or 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's become this deadly dull grind of disinformation and the government's out to squash us, and by the way, it has to be aliens, and there's 10 different, and up on, and it's all so earnest and deadly serious, and nobody has any fun with it anymore. And if you're right, Alfred, if you're right and they are aliens or whatever they are, and if it is some sort of extraterrestrial intelligence or any kind of non-human intelligence, whatever it might be, I look at it and I go, this is exciting and adventurous and fun, and it opens up all sorts of new realities. Something else Greg and I were talking about, and I put a clip up on YouTube of an interview I did with him. I mean, what do UFOs represent? Well, who knows, but it represents an opportunity for humans to start thinking of themselves in different ways. And if nothing else, that's a good thing. Like thinking of, as Dan would say, as Earthlings, or as I might say, as all humans, human beings with commonalities, and there may be other intelligences out there that, I don't mean this in a bad way, but we could unite against in the sense that we would view ourselves as humans. There is something else, and hey, this is a new opportunity to experience new things. And honestly, fellas, most of that's what turns me most off about ufology is, and I think these other guys too, from talking to them, it's just not fun. Stick your head up over the parapet and sort of offer a different theory or say, I'd like to think about this in a different way. And it's like World War One, trench warfare. Suddenly, you know, everybody's firing at you. And it's fine if they want to critique your work, but it sometimes seems so terribly dull, serious, and personal, as if you're almost attacking them. With one exception in my background, one exception, here you go, Alfred, here it comes, which was Richard Dolan, where the attack wasn't meant personal, but I can see how it was when I reviewed his book a couple of years ago. And Rich and I are fine now. We had drinks. We were fine before, and now we're fine now. So I regretted that, at least the tone. But since then, yeah, it's so personal. And I know that Nick and Greg and Mac and I and others, the younger fellas, we just kind of go, and I know I'm rambling, but I really did want to make this point. It's just not fun. So why would we do it when there are so many other things on this planet?
Well, that was going to be my question. What keeps you hanging in there?
Well, because Nick and Greg and Mac and I and a few others are that small, small group of people who, even if it's not always fun, we are genuinely interested in the mystery. In Nick Redfern's case, he's interested in a lot of mysteries, and so is Greg. And Mac, for me, it's less cryptos and UFOs are just something I'm interested in. But it would be so much more easy to devote time to it if it wasn't such a deadly, dull grind, you know, and people weren't so... And people should be serious. I'm one of the leading advocates for serious scientific inquiry. I know real scientists. They have fun. You sit these guys down, they start talking about quantum mechanics, they get jacked up, like excited.
Yeah, but Paul, it's all over the television, it's in ads, it's two or three programs on television every night. It's always in your face. It's always some newspaper article, somebody's written a new book. I mean, it's always there. It's just not going away. To what do you attribute all of that?
I know people look at the UFO thing and they say, oh, yeah, there's all these television shows about it. I think The X-Files was a horrible thing for the UFO phenomenon for a host of reasons. I thought it was a great television show, But if you wanted serious study of the UFO phenomena, it was terrible because it focused people on all of this government conspiracy stuff. And I'm not saying there isn't one. I'm just saying I don't think that should be the focus. Because when you have that many good cases out there, you should just ignore the government and go about your business of investigating cases, talking to witnesses. And then
we're finding that increasingly difficult to do down here, ignore the government, that is.
Well, you might not want to ignore the government in terms of a general sense. Honestly, I think there are bigger things to fry government with these days than the UFO phenomenon.
If true, that would be the big one, though, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, if true, absolutely. As Nick Redfern would say, interesting, or sorry, not Nick Redfern, Nick Pope, interesting if true, which is his catchphrase, which is why I like Nick, because that's a great catchphrase. But you have to differentiate between serious media attention and entertainment, and The X-Files is entertainment, The Outer Limits is entertainment. It's science fiction the same way it's always been science fiction. And aliens existed in science fiction before 1947, the Roswell Kenneth Arnold date, the H.G. Wells and other stuff. But people were writing about aliens, War of the Worlds, Martians with Orson Welles. They were writing about that kind of stuff and doing plays and whatever before UFOs became big news. So it should come as no surprise that UFOs and aliens and all that sort of stuff are still big news because it's part of the popular culture. So is religion. People make films about God and all that. The same general reasons. People want to think about other intelligences, things we don't know about, and space exploration. And that's my other bugaboo. So when did space exploration become dull? When I did my conference, I brought Bob Zimmerman up. It has nothing to do with UFOs. I think it's a horrible mistake, and I don't think it's a conscious mistake, but let's say a missed opportunity that maybe people interested in UFOs should take seriously again. You should be linking space exploration, and Max certainly does this. He's a big fan of space exploration, with the UFO phenomenon. And one of the things I often say is, well, if you want to find out if aliens are visiting Earth, probably the best way to do it is to go out there and look. Like, say hello. So head to Mars. So I had Zimmerman up. I mean, if you're interested in UFOs, I think you should be interested in space exploration, too, and vice versa. At least in terms of space exploration, you should be interested in the idea of some form of extraterrestrial intelligence. And we might find it on Mars. So I know that he doesn't have very much credit left in your country, but the one thing that history might remember your current president kindly for, and honestly, I believe in 100 years or 200 years of the Iraq War, despite the fact that it's a huge mess and we're all terribly concerned about it, will be, as most British colonial wars were, a footnote in a history book. And that's the British used to be terribly concerned about these kind of things, too, 100 and 200 years ago, and now they're footnotes in history books, and nobody remembers them.
I don't think so, but we can agree to disagree there.
Being a historian myself, I like to take the long-term view, so I think that's the way it's going to go. But regardless, he's the guy that started talking for whatever reason, and I don't even care what the reason was. But the first president in decades, not Clinton, not Carter, not Bush, the previous one, about going to Mars.
Where are we lately on that, Paul?
Well, everything has to start somewhere. He actually talked about it, and he's not going to be the guy who's around to fund it or see it through. He'll probably be dead by the time it happens, although who knows. But at least somebody's talking about it. This is not me going pro-Bush. You should be allowed to say something nice about somebody, even if you disagree with everything else they do, without being branded as some Bushy, which some people have done with me. And I'm just saying that your politics to me doesn't matter when it comes to space exploration. You can be Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, the raving monster loony party. As long as you're saying NASA should be taken seriously and let's get out in space, then I think you deserve a little check in the win column. And in the long run, hundreds of years from now, when people are remembering what hopefully set the human race on a course that I think it should be on, which is exploration, and maybe we find aliens out there, hopefully people will look back and say, yeah, despite all the problems, at least he got one thing right. So space exploration, that's something else that the UFO community should talk more about. And instead, what you often hear from them is, NASA is evil. NASA's covering up. My experience is NASA isn't covering up. Talking about best evidence, I can tell you who is covering up, Lockheed Martin. Try getting anything out of Lockheed Martin, forget it. I wanted a photo of Kelly Johnson, just a photo of Kelly Johnson to stick in. And no, as soon as I mentioned UFOs, they wanted nothing to do with it. And I tried explaining to a successive number of people at Lockheed, look, Kelly Johnson, one of your founders, great guy, he actually saw a UFO, well, two at least, one that's in the film. His pilots, his engineers, all of these people that worked for you, they filed reports on Lockheed stationery. So it's nothing you need to be embarrassed or ashamed about. Nope, they wanted nothing to do with it. No photos for you. NASA, on the other hand, because we have the Skylab 3 case in there, I called NASA up, and they were like, well, where do you want to ship it to? And I said, well, you can send it to COD to me. COD? Oh, good heavens, no. Do you want that overnight courier, those photos, or the regular mail? And I said, I'll take it courier, I guess. Are you paying for that? And they went, yes, of course, sure. Which photos do you want again? Do you have the numbers? No. And so they found them for me. Let me tell you, from my point of view, NASA is the cat's meow, because I asked them for UFO photos, and they were like, sure, here you go. Take them. Put them on air. We used some footage in the Kelly Johnson case. Here's the great irony. We used footage of the Blackbird. I think it's the SR-71 Blackbird in the Kelly Johnson case. I didn't get that from Lockheed, but I wouldn't even ask after the photo thing for footage. No, I went on the NASA website, and we ripped it off the NASA website, because the NASA website says, as long as you don't show our logo, you can use this stuff for whatever you want. And the post-production guys just pulled it out, and we stuck it in the film. I mean, NASA, hooray. So instead, though, you get UFO guys, a lot of them, who seem to think NASA is covering all sorts of stuff up. And I would say that if NASA was covering something up, they wouldn't even let me have those Skylab photos, especially once they knew what I was going to do with them, and I'm very clear about that. But they were extremely helpful, so I don't think they're involved in some sort of cover-up, and I think that's something that the UFO field could profit from, is trying to link yourself to something that people still are kind of jacked up about, which is space exploration.
Still, I'm eyes askance and arms akimbo with regard to officialdom in this area. They don't seem to be forthcoming with some of the stuff that they could be forthcoming with, and they could go a long way, I think, toward pulling the lid off this whole thing and getting some real disclosure, if I may use that word.
I think part of the problem is that NASA doesn't have a department for looking into that kind of thing. They've been pruned back over the years to the point where there's too much work and too few bodies to do a lot of that work. Plus, of course, the reason for their openness and helpfulness is that they're a public body, whereas Lockheed Martin, Rockwell, and those other organizations are not. They're corporations. It's public money that funds NASA, and they don't want any complaints about them not cooperating with the media.
Hey, look, the CIA was cooperative with me a couple of years ago when I was doing another film, too. I suppose if you asked what's the truth about the Kennedy assassination, they might have been less cooperative. But if you're just looking for photos and footage and stuff like that and usage rights, they're incredibly cooperative. Private enterprise, you're quite right, different story. And Richard Dolan made this point in his lecture at the X conference. Here's how I would phrase it. If there was an alien spacecraft ever recovered, big, huge if for me. But if there was, where would it be now? Who would have it? And I think Dolan's point, as I understood it, was it wouldn't be with government. It would be with private enterprise. And on that, I would agree with them, assuming you accept the premise. I think it is hard to keep a secret. I honestly don't believe the government knows anything. I think they know there's something up there in the sense that there are UFO reports, and here I agree with Nick Pope, but I think they are genuinely befuddled as to what they are and usually don't attach terribly much importance to them because they have other things to do. So that's my view on disclosure in the grand cosmic Watergate. I just don't think it exists. They're as confused as we are. But if you do believe that there is an alien spacecraft or something like that, then I would think it would be in the hands of private enterprise. And Dolan's point was, because they're not subject to freedom of information or anything, they're generally speaking not subject to any oversight at all, at least in terms of many of their black programs. So you'd pawn it off to people like Lockheed Martin or Halliburton or Boeing for whatever reason. If you talk about plausible deniability, if you had done that, it's quite likely that the president wouldn't know. Senators wouldn't know. Generals wouldn't know. There would be a very small group who might know. But instead, it's all sort of diffused throughout private enterprise. And they can basically do what they did to me. And all I was asking for was a photo of a guy who's been dead for 15, 20 years.
Doesn't trouble seem to befall people who do make some kind of investigation? Seems Carter had his problems and Clinton has his own problems with trying to get some UFO questions answered.
Well, it depends on how you view problems. I would say, from my perspective, that there's just nobody around to answer the questions, in the sense that they don't know the answers. And this, switching from Dolan to Nick Pope, this was Nick Pope's mantra when he was at the X conference, which is, there's all this interesting information coming up from the Ministry of Defense in phases, and that's, it's no great conspiracy, it's just how government works. You release some stuff, and then more and more, and eventually it's all out there. And he said that's how it's happening. And that's not surprising. But the end result of what they're going to release, he said, is, look, there's all these cases, they're all very interesting, and the government, meaning the Ministry of Defense and everybody else in the United Kingdom, has no idea what it represents. And that's it, period, full stop. There is nothing more. That's what he would say. There's no spaceships in some hangar in Lakenheath or someplace. And that's the view I buy into. And so there's Nick on one side. But on the other hand, Richard Dolan, who does think that there are these conspiracies, he makes sense, too, in the sense if you believe that those things exist, the way he describes how they would exist makes perfect sense to me. And this is why, to me, disclosure, i.e. the thing that Bassett promotes, the movement to get government to disclose, I think it's goofy for a bunch of reasons, not the least of which is if there is this secret that you think exists, I don't think the government's the one that's holding it anymore. So what are they going to disclose? They don't even know the truth, if that is the truth. So your disclosure movement should probably be directed at picketing Lockheed Martin or whatever. Good luck.
Which brings us back around to the disclosure conference, and you did that rather neatly.
I thought so.
How well attended was it in your estimation?
Well, it was pretty good. Attendance is down across the UFO conferences, thanks to the Internet and other things. I think he probably had maybe 200 people. There's no question that when Greer was speaking, it was packed. You could, standing room only. Some of the other speakers were pretty close. And the final banquet was packed. McAbee was playing the piano. And it was great fun. He had a good turnout. I think he was very pleased, and he should be, despite whatever disagreements I might have about exopolitics. He put on a good show. It was well-run, well-attended, well-organized. So kudos to Stephen Bassett for putting on what, and I've attended a few now, was probably the best UFO conference I've been at, just in terms of organizing it and putting on a good show. People got their money's worth. There's no question about that. So.
How was your film received down there by the people?
Well, it's hard to tell because Bassett left before it was over, and he didn't turn the lights on. So in terms of actually judging audience reaction from looking at them, couldn't see. I did a Q&A afterwards in the dark. I'm not kidding. It was literally still dark in the hall. So at one point I saw a hand go up, and I say, "Sir or madam," and don't take that personally. I just can't see whether you're a man or a woman. But you, over there, ask a question.
Why couldn't you get any light?
It was a large room, and Bassett was the only person who really knew where the lights were. So I know it sounds very odd, but nobody thought to stand up and turn the lights on. So there was a light on stage. It was like you were talking to an alien with light shining down on me. I was the alien guy, and everybody else was in the dark.
Mm-hmm.
Wizard of Oz or something.
Yeah, man in a spotlight.
Exactly. But a good applause reaction, and everybody I talked to afterwards, including I met some people who I know don't like me or didn't like me beforehand, and they all walked away saying, "Oh, well, maybe we were wrong," or a few of them walked away saying, "Maybe you've changed." And I would say, "No, I haven't changed. You were wrong." You know, I didn't hear a bad word said about it, which was very gratifying. And the nice thing about the film, as I pointed out, is from across the spectrum, and I would put you on one end of the spectrum, Alfred, and I mean no disrespect when I say that, but you fit into a certain camp, and I'm not trying to pigeonhole you either. I'm being very careful here. I don't want to start another war. But you're on the UFO magazine side, let's just say that, what people would generally call the believer side. That's fine. And you like the film. Over on the other side, what many people would call the debunking side or even the skeptical side, the Fortean Times and other groups like that, the British types, they liked it too. So mission accomplished for me. It's a film that appealed to everybody, and so everybody can get something out of it. And why I wanted to go to the X conference was to make sure that people heard my view of what the film represented so that it wasn't misrepresented.
Mm.
And my view, as the guy who made it, is, look, it's a mystery. Science, government, journalism should be taking it seriously, but we don't know what the answer is. But look at these 10 cases and guys like Bob Salas and Kelly Johnson and others and tell me that there isn't something up there that we should take more seriously. And these 10 cases are just, as Dick Hall would say, 10 of the best, not the 10 best, although in the RB-47 case I think it is. But, you know, there are so many other cases. I'm actually hoping to do a sequel or two, like the next 10, or do the Father Gill case in New Guinea and some other cases. There's a great case in France that Jacques Vallée really likes that almost nobody in ufology knows about or ever talks about. One from a place called Vins-sur-Caramy that had multiple witnesses, one of whom was a gendarme. It was actually investigated by the French police. And that's the other great thing that I liked about my film. I'm reviewing my own film, but one of the things I certainly wanted to make sure of, two things. One, that the case number 10, the Nuremberg case, which I did put in, and I've made no bones about that. That was an editorial decision. I wanted to make sure that people understood that this wasn't just 1947 on, that this was a phenomenon that had been with us for hundreds or even thousands of years. Fine. But more importantly, that it wasn't just an American phenomenon, which I think a lot of people think it is. Oh, those crazy, kooky, wacky Americans. Nuts. No, it's a worldwide phenomenon. So you've got the Iranian case, and you've got the Rendlesham case, and you've got two cases from Canada, could have been more, and the Nuremberg case is German. But we also had cases that received significant numbers of votes, as I made clear at the end of the film, from Brazil and Japan and Australia and New Guinea and on and on and on, and France. So the next film, if there is one, would actually be even more international. There would be fewer American cases, as it turns out, and it would really show the international flavor of the phenomenon. And I think that's something that really gets lost in the mix sometimes, especially because of Roswell, which is American and is so associated with the UFO phenomenon, which I think was a mistake. But leaving that aside, people need to know that it's happening in their countries as well, even if their own governments aren't talking about it. And that's the nice thing about the United States. For all its flaws, at least people can talk. They can stand up and shout in the public square about UFOs or whatever else they want to talk about. And there are other countries around the world where there are UFO sightings where you can't talk about it, or anything else for that matter. So at least there's a conversation going on here, and the question is, well, how do you take that conversation out of the small group of people that have it and try and maybe get more people interested in the phenomenon and talking about it and looking at it? Disclosure is not the biggest challenge for ufology. The biggest challenge for ufology is how do you get people interested in it again and talking about it, and in a way that is more than just watching the X-Files on TV and going, well, that was fun. But how do you get them seriously interested in whatever's flying around up in our skies?
Yeah.
Again, how can they not be interested given all of the ad infrastructure, people trying to sell everything from ice cream cones to washing machines, all of the documentaries that are being made that are being shown over and over and over again on television? How is the interest not there given all that?
Well, most of the documentaries are crap, first of all, including maybe one or two of mine. I don't know. I'll leave that up to the critics. But most films that are made about UFOs are utter, unmitigated crap. And I make no bones about saying that. I hope your friend David Cherniak, Errol, his film turns out to be good.
Everything else that he's done has been very, very tasty, and there's no reason why it wouldn't turn out to be good.
Well, he's one of Canada's foremost filmmakers. He's farther up the food chain than I am. A guy named Mark Tilkington out of the United Kingdom has been working on one called Mirage Men, which is more about the disinformation angle, but still. I know Greg Bishop was heavily involved in the making of that. They actually interviewed Richard Doty and some other people. I think Bill Moore even was interviewed for that, although I'm not sure. So I'm hoping that that's a good documentary, because that's an important angle on the overall story, certainly from a historical context. But by and large, most of the films are crap, honestly. And a lot of them repeat the same motifs, and they use the same footage, and I don't even know what the viewership is, but I know what the network here in Canada has told me. They're making films about zombies now, Alfred, just in case you were curious. Zombies are hot in Canada. UFOs are not. And so, yes, there are films out there, there are ads and stuff, but I don't think that amounts to serious interest. If somebody, and I'll go back to the religious motif again, starts using Jesus to advertise Coke or Volkswagen or whatever, besides offending a lot of people, even me, and I'm not religious, would that be a sign of serious interest in religion, or at least in Christianity, that one religion? I would go, no.
But anything in the consciousness, and it's really a little misleading, I think, Paul, you know, with all respect, to confuse the issue between UFOs and Jesus like that, because we're really talking apples and oranges there. People aren't going to be offended by UFOs, but they are going to be offended by the use of Jesus in a similar milieu.
The point that I'm trying to make, maybe I didn't do it very well, is if you use Jesus in the same way that you're suggesting that UFOs are used in the, or aliens or whatever, in the popular consciousness, I don't think it would be a sign that anybody's taking it seriously. I would, in fact, to me, it would be a sign that nobody's taking seriously, because it had moved into the realm of corporate advertising, and it was now just being used as a tool to sell Kit Kat bars or whatever. I don't mean to pick on the good folks at Nestle, whoever makes Kit Kat. But instead, you don't get that for a whole host of reasons. But with UFOs, you do. And so I would say quality trumps quantity. And the fact that aliens and all of these memes are embedded in the popular consciousness, to me, is meaningless unless it's embedded in the popular consciousness and actually doing something constructive. And I don't think it is, at least in terms of studying the UFO phenomenon. Maybe the one thing it's doing is making people more open to the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence someday. But I don't think it's making them more open, if you happen to be an ETHer, to the idea that UFOs are real and extraterrestrials are flitting about the planet Earth. So I would say it's a whole bunch of noise, but there's not much substance there. And instead, what you still have is an extremely small group of people, men and women, who take the UFO phenomenon seriously. And I go back to my comment, which is the trick for ufology from here on in is to take guys like Nick Pope and Mac Tonies and others and try and use them as, what did you call it, Alfred, a spearhead? I can't remember in your review, but something like that, to try and pierce the public consciousness and get people interested in looking at the phenomenon again and not looking at the fact that you've got a green alien guy with big bug eyes, as they do in Roswell, on a machine advertising Coca-Cola. There's nothing wrong with that. I just don't think it's particularly helpful. So, yeah, that's my take on it.
Where and when can listeners around the world hope to catch UFOs, the best evidence, your documentary?
In Canada, it's airing, they don't tell me, but it'll be airing for the next 4 years on Space, the Imagination Station. The exact dates, I don't know. In New Zealand, it'll start airing on TVNZ, Television New Zealand, probably in December. And then distributor was just at MIP, which is big television sales brouhaha over in France. Haven't heard back from them yet, but who knows, maybe they've sold it to other countries, but they're actively working on that.
Are you actively working on the DVD version?
No, I will be. I have another film, totally unrelated to UFOs, it's about classical music, that I'm behind on for Bravo, so I have to finish that first. That'll be done in a few weeks, so probably December, the Christmas break, when I will turn my attention to the DVD extras of Best Evidence, and it'll probably be a two-disc set, although it might actually be a three-disc set. There's so much good stuff. Pope's only in the film for 45 seconds, and I interviewed him for an hour in the UK. Max in for 3 minutes, and I got an hour and a half of footage with him. That's the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of talking head stuff that networks don't like to see. However, the people that are interested in the subject matter as bonus materials, I think, would like to see more of Mac Tonies just talking.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nick Pope just talking. So that's probably mostly what's going to be in the DVD extras, along with maybe some of the animation that we didn't use and some other cool little things. But by and large, it's just going to be these guys talking. And I think that alone will be worth the exorbitant price of admission. Or whatever.
And serve ufological history well in the future.
Well, I hope so. And that's one of the things that I like to do. Even when I go on the road, like when Chris and I did, I took a camera with me. I was filming a bunch of stuff for a bunch of different reasons. But I took the time to pop in and interview Peter Gersten in Arizona. Lovely man. Don't agree with a lot of what he says, but he's a nice guy.
How could you?
Yeah. Well, he wanted to kill himself in 2012. What are you going to do? But he's a piece of UFO history. No matter what he might believe now, I think it's good to get him on the record. And some of the stuff he talked about, he did actually, I asked him about UFOs too. I haven't put that up yet. But, and I interviewed Greg Bishop as well, you know, and asked him a few more questions. Every time I see these guys, I ask them a few questions. People can go to YouTube or wherever and say, oh, well, let's just type in UFO and they'll see all these interviews I've done. I was hoping maybe to get a chance to do that at the X conference with all these guys. I just didn't have time. I mean, I was busy doing the conference thing. So next time I go to a conference, maybe in April or whenever Bassett's next conference is, I'll just go with my camera and interview people. By the way, I feel obliged to mention, too, having said that almost all UFO documentaries are crap, at least one of the exceptions, and that's a guy named, I know you know him, Errol, Mike McDonald, who's a colleague of mine out here in Halifax, and he's done very good work, Sag Harbor UFO Incident, Northern Lights. But he's got a new one coming out this winter. He's just finishing it now, called The Intruders, or Intruders. I'm not sure if there's a the. And it's about the alien abduction phenomenon. And I know he interviewed both Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs extensively. I have an advanced copy sitting in my living room that I have to look at because I'm doing some story editing for him on it. But that should, you know, if you're interested in the abduction phenomenon, that knowing the good work that Mike's done in the past, I'm sure that's something that you'll want to tune into this winter. Keep an eye out for it coming on Space, the Imagination Station.
Ah, yes. And available all over the plamdanit, not.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Well, the good news, bad news. The good news is in Canada, until they went on their current zombie kick, Space has been very good about funding films by guys like Mike and I and allowing us to talk seriously, I think, about the UFO phenomenon, even as we try and entertain. And you always have to understand that you have to do both in my business. The bad news is we're Canadians, and Canada and the global television market is a drop in the bucket, just totally overshadowed by the behemoth that is the United States. And Canadians are not terribly good at getting their films out there because we need distributors, and it's a long story. But a lot of our films show in Canada and then never go any further, except maybe DVDs. I think a lot of that is starting to change. Mike and I both have distributors now. The internet is certainly very helpful. DVDs are still there. So hopefully more people will see these films, and hopefully they'll go back and visit. I just did a distribution deal for Stanton T. Friedman Israel, the first film I ever did as a director. So that one will be appearing on internet streaming and hopefully television as well sometime in 2008. So for all those folks that haven't seen that one, the bio of Stan Friedman will be much more accessible in a few months. And that's a good thing.
Good to hear, too. Yeah, yes. Absolutely. Anything else that you'd like to get into, either of you?
Again, I would like to say thank you, Alfred, for your good review, and on behalf of Chris again as well. And thanks to you guys and Dave Frelott and everybody else listening who might have given the film a good review, not just on my behalf or Chris's behalf. And I know, Errol, you and I had this conversation once before. Somebody called it Paul Kimball's best evidence. And in a sense, that might be true. But in a very real sense, it's the best evidence of everybody who worked on it. I really do mean that. And watch the end credits, folks, to see who all those people are. But also thanks to everybody who voted, by which I mean all the UFO researchers who provided me with their top 10 list that allowed me to then average out the final top 10 list. And then most importantly, thanks to Brad Sparks, who was our lead consultant on the project, without whom I probably couldn't have made the film, or certainly not nearly as good as it is. And Stan and Dick Hall and all the people who were interviewed for the film. And last but not least, and I always like to do this, thanks to Charles Halt, Bob Salas, who is a good friend of mine. Not that Halt isn't, I just don't know him beyond the interview, but he's a good guy. And Bruce Bailey, who had never talked about the RB-47 case, his own incident before, which is different than the classic 1957 one. And he was willing to sit down and talk to me about it. So I would like to think that all the criticisms I've gotten over the years for maybe sitting on the fence or whatever, I didn't plan it this way, that's actually what I believe, but it does allow me, when I approach people like Bailey, he asked, he checked around, and he said, well, okay, you seem like a serious guy who's not just saying aliens are real and all that sort of stuff. You seem skeptical. You I'll talk to. And I think that kind of approach I've noticed allows me to get access to people that maybe wouldn't talk to other people. And I think that my final comment, Errol and Alfred, would be in terms of ufology in general, whatever, that's probably the way they should go about it, because I think you will find more people are willing to talk to you and listen to you if you take that more skeptical but open-minded approach that I talked about for years now, and that I think the younger guys like Nick and Greg and Mac represent. So there you go.
And there indeed we go. Paul Kimball, thank you.
Thanks, fellas.
Alfred Lemberg, thank you.
You're most graciously welcome, sir.
And we'll doubtlessly talk to you next time, Alfred Lemberg, and look forward to talking with you again, Paul. It's always good. And the many times that you've been on the program has been very satisfying for me in person, myself. My own greed and attitude likes having you on.
Well, Strange Days Indeed was the first radio show, as I recall, that I ever did, talking about UFOs. And it's like the first girl you ever kissed. You may move on and kiss other girls. But, you know, you always have very fond memories of the first one you ever kissed, or at least I do. Of all the radio guys who interview me, you're the one that seems to get it best. And you knew the Beatles.
That's a whole beat of a different color, I think. And that wraps up this edition, number 450. 450, I'm still marveling. Of Strange Days Indeed. My thanks to Dave Frelott, Don Ledger, Paul Kimball, and the almost ever-present Alfred Lemberg. Thank you for being out there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. We'll talk to you next time.
That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.